Thank you, everyone. We have a quorum here. I'll call the House Labor Committee to order. Members, you're going to find a copy of the minutes of the February 27, 2019 meeting in your folder. Are there any additions or corrections? Hearing none, Representative Detmer, would you like to move the minutes?
Will do, Chair.
Thank you. The minutes have been moved. Thank you, Representative Detmer. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Next, we found some errors in the previous meeting minutes. The start times were listed as 3:30 instead of 2:30. You have copies of those corrected minutes in your packet if you want to give them a look, or we can simply move along. So I will move that we reconsider the vote by which the minutes from January 30th, 2019 were approved. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Minutes from the January 30th, 2019 are now back before the committee. I will seek a motion to approve these minutes as corrected.
Will we approve them as corrected?
Representative Nelson moves the adoption of the minutes from January 30th, 2019. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes. The minutes are adopted as corrected. We also have the minutes from February 6th, 2019 to correct as well. So I will move that we reconsider the vote by which the minutes from February 6th, 2019 were approved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. The minutes from February 6, 2019 are now back before the committee. I will seek a motion to approve these minutes as corrected. Representative Lippert moves the minutes. Adoption of the minutes from February 6, 2019. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Representative
Eckert. Opposed? Okay, the motion passes and are adopted as corrected. Next on the agenda is Representative Stevenson and House File 1507.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Detmer,
whose clock were we going by? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. I will move that just for a matter of housekeeping, we limit the time spent on the three bills to approximately 25 minutes each, and we will be voting on this one on or before the 25-minute mark. Next on the agenda, Representative Stevenson, I will move that House File 1507 be re-referred to Ways and Means. Now that we have the bill before us, we also have an A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would ask the committee if they would adopt the A1 author's amendment, which gets the bill in the shape that I'd like the committee to consider it in.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment before us? All those in favor of adopting the A1, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Say nay. Okay, motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Stevenson, you may proceed. We do have two testifiers for this bill, I understand.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of this committee. This is an exciting time in Minnesota in the biomanufacturing space. We really have an opportunity to see some really exciting industry develop in the state. If we have the tools and the workforce available to help that industry grow. And what House File 1507 really is about is making sure that DEED has the tools necessary to support this industry, which has great potential and great promise here in Minnesota as we continue to develop advanced manufacturing economy. And it really has two pieces. One deals with changes to the Minnesota Investment Fund, and the second has to do with changes to our workforce development programs, again, in effort to make sure that we have the tools to adequately provide support to a growing industry in Minnesota. And, Mr. Chair, that's correct that I do have two testifiers with me today who I think can give the members of the committee a real flavor of the opportunities that are available to the people of Minnesota and to our economy if we move forward with this bill. And so I'd turn it over to them at this time.
Thank you. Can testifier please testifiers both identify themselves and then proceed.
Thank you. John Schlatter, State Government Affairs Director for Takeda Pharmaceuticals.
Lily Melander, Government Relations Manager with Medical Alley Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Stevenson. My name is John Schlatter, as I stated. I'd like to take a few minutes to talk to you today a little bit about the opportunity before you, Takeda's support of this legislation, and a little bit about Takeda's history in Minnesota. Takeda is a global biopharmaceutical company headquartered in Japan with a 230-year history. We are a patient-centered, value-based company focused on discovering and delivering innovative treatments for unmet medical needs in about 80 countries around the world. The state of Minnesota is an important part of the Takeda story. Takeda has a biologics manufacturing facility in Brooklyn Park. This facility will produce a life-changing treatment for people living with Crohn's and colitis. Takeda conducted a global search to determine where we were going to put this manufacturing facility. And when we discovered that Minnesota had an inactive biologics manufacturing facility, Takeda seized the opportunity to locate operations here. Through the process, Takeda has developed a strong working relationship with Deed and the city of Brooklyn Park. And those are relationships that we value very much. They're very helpful to us, and we appreciate the state and the local community. The process of manufacturing biologics is technical, and it's a very sophisticated process. Takeda has invested over $75 million in the facility in Brooklyn Park, and we have about 230 people who work there today. Takeda is here today in support of House File 1507 and the tools it will provide to grow the life sciences industry in Minnesota. Support of the Minnesota Investment Fund was one of the critical factors that led Takeda to choose the Brooklyn Park location. This legislation strengthens Deed's ability to recruit new companies and foster growth for existing companies such as Takeda. As this committee has probably heard many times, a skilled workforce is a really critical issue when people are trying to decide where to locate. It's exciting, actually, this week, Takeda is excited that Deed approved a Minnesota Jobs partnership grant with the University of Minnesota. So the University of Minnesota and Takeda are going to work together on a new program that is going to provide training for students in biologics manufacturing. And when you think about the concept of the ecosystem and giving companies the tools they need, this is going to be, I think, hopefully a really exciting example of that. And certainly a key component of this bill, the bill in front of you, is an increase in the jobs training grant program. We support the bill in front of you, and we hope that it will help grow the life sciences industry in this state. We look forward to partnering with you and others who decide to start or move to Minnesota because of this legislation. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Committee, my name is Lily Melander. I work with Medical Alley Association. We are the cross-sector healthcare association that supports and advances the global leadership of Medical Alley healthcare industry. This past year, Medical Alley Association convened working groups composed of healthcare leaders from all sectors to put together a 10-year vision with the goal of Medical Alley being recognized as a global epicenter of health innovation and care. These working groups concluded that in order to realize the vision, there were four major challenges that needed to be addressed. One was that Minnesota must grow our existing talent pool and better prepare our existing workforce to impact the future of healthcare. Another, that Minnesota must provide an opportunity or an environment that attracts investment, increases the opportunity for health technology and care organizations to succeed. This bill takes steps forward towards meeting both of those challenges. By expanding the jobs training incentive program, it enables companies seeking to grow the opportunity to partner with the public sector to train employees for newly created positions. By limiting the program to only manufacturing and IT sectors, it focuses in not only where some of the greatest needs are, but some of the highest wages as well. There were over 117,000 jobs posting for manufacturing IT jobs in 2018. And these two industries have an average wage of $43,000 higher than the average wage of all other industries. The MIF program has also been key to growing the health innovation and care industry in Minnesota. Smiths Medical used MIF to build its new headquarters in Plymouth. Takeda leveraged it for its new Global Center of Excellence in Brooklyn Park. And in Rochester, Viriad received assistance in building a state-of-the-art manufacturing facility for anti-cancer vaccines. These are just some of the success stories for MIF-funded projects. Increasing the MIF ceiling will enable the state to keep and attract jobs in Minnesota in a timely fashion and makes the maximum awards consistent across similar programs. Essentially, what this bill does, it expands the job incentive or job training incentive program to the metro area, increases the program funding from $1.3 million to $3 million, and splits that between Greater Minnesota and the metro. It increases the maximum award from $200,000 to $400,000 and limits it to only IT and manufacturing and retains the required salary requirements. It also increases MIF maximum to $2 million to match the jobs creation fund. To conclude, to truly realize the vision of becoming the global epicenter of health innovation and care, Minnesota must grow our existing talent pool, prepare our existing workforce, and provide an environment that attracts investment and increases the opportunity for health innovation and care organizations to succeed. This bill takes big steps in addressing those challenges. Thank you.
My thanks to the testifiers. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on the bill, support or opposition to this? Seeing none at this point, any questions to the testifiers and the author? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this bill is troubling for me. I heard your testimony. You said it shifts resources from rural Minnesota to the metro. That's very concerning to me, members. And I don't like the fact that we're limiting it to manufacturing and technology. I understand that there are need for those, but there's need for lots of other training, the grants that are being distributed through here. I appreciate the amendment that you brought forth. That helps a little bit. But, and I heard the testimony, Representative Stevenson, tell me, is it your intention to further exclude rural Minnesota from this program?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, actually, I don't think that the bill shifts resources from rural to metro, and I missed that. If that was something that I said, then I misspoke, and if it's something that someone else said, I would have to respectfully disagree. So the bill, as it presently does allow the metro to participate in this program, but it expands the amount of money available. In the last biennium, $1.375 million was available per year. This bill makes $3 million available and reserves 50% of it to Greater Minnesota. So the portion of funds that are available to Greater Minnesota actually increases under this bill. It further expands the program into the metro. So it is certainly not my intention to exclude Greater Minnesota, and I would argue that the bill actually brings more resources to Greater Minnesota.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask Mr. McKinnon from the Department of Employment and Economic Development to come up, please?
Mr. McKinnon, do you have some input for us? Please identify yourself.
Thanks. My name is Kevin McKinnon. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Economic Development at DEED.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McKinnon, Director McKinnon, you heard my questions about this impact on rural Minnesota. Can you help me out? The $1.3 million that has been going to rural Minnesota, I don't see that guaranteed in this bill, and if I'm reading it wrong, I apologize, members, but help me out how the department sees this bill.
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Chair, members, the current structure of the Greater Minnesota or the Jobs Training Incentive Program is only available outside of the 7-county metro area, and there is $1.35 million or so available each year in that program. What I see here under Subdivision 4 suggests that after March 31st, funds would be available to the entire state. But before that, 50% has to be available for Greater Minnesota.
Okay. All righty.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that we get things on the records here. The other question that I had then is, why the change to just manufacturing and technology? There are many MIF opportunities available in rural Minnesota that don't involve manufacturing and technology.
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the restriction on manufacturing and technology, if I can just 1 minute.
Yep.
That's what I thought. I just wanted to confirm that I was speaking correctly before I answered your question, and I am correct that the focus on manufacturing and technology isn't a change to MIF, it's a change to the job right. development. So when you say there are MIF opportunities agreements, so it wouldn't affect that. But I still take your question as being applicable to job training too. And so I think that you heard Ms. Melander talk about the exceptional need that exists in the manufacturing information space. And so focusing our resources on that area, which is so critical to the state's economy and where there's such opportunity, and most importantly, where we're facing workforce shortages, is important.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for how I worded my question, but that being said, it takes me back to, and I understand that, there's a critical workforce shortage in rural Minnesota as well, and not necessarily just in manufacturing and technology. And so that's why I have some concerns about this. I'm hoping that whoever you're working with in the Senate on this bill, you know, would actually, you guys would consider making the program more expansive and more available to more different types of businesses in rural Minnesota. And Mr. Chair, if I may, the other thing that I have concern about is on lines 1.9 and 1.10, there's not a lot of capital investment projects in rural Minnesota that have at least $25 million investment and 150 new employees. I can think of one in particular in my district that fits into this, but again, I see this as not something that would particularly be beneficial to rural Minnesota, and I'm wondering why we have got these numbers in this part of the bill.
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the existing limit of $1 million allows for broad distribution of the funds. The sense that I have is that if we're going to increase the amount of money that we are investing in one particular project, that we want to make sure that we're getting ample return on our investment. And that's why we're including language as to the amount of the capital investment and new employees that are required. Of course, there's nothing to prevent a project that has less than that from seeking involvement and getting involvement from MIF. They just would be capped at $1 million instead of two.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate the answer, but I still have some concerns about you know, if we're going to do this, let's keep the project or the program more open. I have one other question with regards to in the bill it talks about having to have reports back and so forth. Or do we have to have a report back? Mr. McKinnon is here. The reports that are due back February 1st of 18, talking about the Workforce Development Fund, how has that been working? And you and I talked offline a little bit earlier, and, you know, the $1.3 million in the job training is actually being used in rural Minnesota quite handled now, quite efficiently.
Representative Stevenson, or testifiers?
The question I understood was directed to Mr. McKinnon, so I would defer to him.
Mr. McKinnon.
The job training grants program, there's a report that was due.
And your question around that report, how have we been performing with this? Mr. Chair, members, this program has been around, I think, 2 or 3 years. And the last 3 years, the appropriation went up from $900,000 to $1.3 million in the last year or two. Last year, I believe, we had about $100,000 left over, so firms in greater Minnesota used about $1.2 million. This year, we expect roughly around the same that firms will absorb almost all that appropriation.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just attempting, and I appreciate your indulgence. I'm just trying to make sure that a program that's working well in rural Minnesota continues to be available, and we have the opportunities that I think are critical. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Any other questions to the testifiers or the author? Representative Detmer.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to piggyback on Representative Fabian's on line 2.21, where did that March 31st date come from? Is that a deadline for applications, or where does March 31 come? And then the second part of the question is, let's say all the 50% that was allocated for the outside the metropolitan area was done, they were all allocated, and there was some leftover in the metro area, which probably wouldn't happen, but would those be allocated to the non-metro area?
Representative Stevenson.
I know the language doesn't say that, but what would happen if they all were used in the outside the metro area and there were some left over in the metro area? Wouldn't you want to have the language in there that would say that those could be allocated to the non-metro area?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as to your first question of March 31st, that's 9 months into the fiscal year, so it's an annual grant program. So the idea is just set a deadline close to the end of the year so that if there are leftover funds, they can be appropriated elsewhere. That's where the date comes from. As to your second question, I think if you take a look at Subdivision 4 and Section 4 in that section, you'll see that there's not a reservation of funds for the metro area. So the section reserves funds for Greater Minnesota, does not reserve funds for the metro. It just says that the other 50 are available to the metro. In other words, the department could grant more than 50% to Greater Minnesota if that's where the grant applications lead the department. They just can't grant less than unless there isn't sufficient demand as of March 31st. Did I answer your question?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
And thank you. So that's your interpretation, the way the language is written then? Is that what we're saying, that anything that's left over can be used anywhere in the state?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually, I would say that it's not about leftovers. The entire pool is available to Greater Minnesota all year round. Only 50% of it is available to the metro. So it's not what's left over could go to Greater Minnesota. Greater Minnesota has access to the whole pool year round. And when you say my interpretation, this is how I would read this statute. I think the language of the statute is pretty direct on that because it doesn't include language reserving 50% for the metro the way it does reserving 50% for Greater Minnesota. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it might be for Mr. McKinnon. Just curious, what happens with the unused funds now? Does that cancel back to the general fund, or does it stay available for continuing time periods?
One moment here. Mr. McKinnon, proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, each year, if there are leftover funds, they stay within the appropriation and can be used in the following year.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, echoing some of the concerns here for Greater Minnesota, if those funds were left to accrue, that, yes, there may be $1.5 million available each year if, indeed, the metro doesn't come in and have enough demand. But by the same token, if there's accumulating funds there that haven't been used in Greater Minnesota, something large comes along the way now, it's conceivable that after a few more years that there could be $2 million there or whatever from the standpoint that these funds don't cancel, correct?
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Chair, members, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Eklund has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, maybe from the department, how much of the money is left over if we're going to have this conversation generally from year to year? How much goes unused?
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Chair and members, in the past 3 years of us operating this program, there's generally been about $100,000 or less remaining each year. So that would transfer forward into the next year.
Thank you. Any other questions to the testifiers or the author? Thank you very much. Hearing no other questions, Representative Stevenson, do you have any final comments on your bill?
All I would say to the committee is that I think this is an important bill that gives us some tools to encourage and grow an important industry throughout Minnesota, and I would ask for your vote.
Thank you. I'll renew my motion that House File 1507 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. Motion passes.
Next on the agenda is House File 879. Representative Sundin moves that 879 be re-referred to Ways and Means Committee. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the overview states, this bill clarifies portions of the law that relate to indemnification agreements for building and construction contracts for the design, building, or repair of buildings, roads, and bridges. The definition of indemnification agreement is amended to include the term defend, often referred to as the duty to defend, which means the litigation expenses are included as party of the indemnification agreement. The second section amends a section of law that it was enacted in 2013. This section removes project-specific insurance from the list of insurance coverage that parties can contract to require in construction contract agreements. These sections are both effective the day following the final enactment and apply to agreements entered into on or after that date only. With me, I have Patrick Lee O'Halloran. He'll identify himself and his positions on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Lee O'Halloran. I am a partner and founder of law firm Thompson Tarasek Lee O'Halloran. I've been a lawyer for 22-plus years and been practicing most of that time in construction law. The reason we're here is that under current law, subcontractors are being required to defend general contractors even when a general contractor is solely negligent. In 2013, the legislature amended the anti-indemnity statute to make it clear that indemnity agreements in a construction contract can only hold subcontractors responsible to the extent of their own fault or negligence. After that amendment was made, or after that law was passed, general contractors have tried to get around that by increasing their the obligations to defend the general contractor. And under current law, you can now be required to defend a general contractor for something by paying their legal fees throughout a dispute that you couldn't be legally required to indemnify them for. This practice is unfair, dangerous, and passes all the risk down onto the smallest construction businesses. If you pass H-File 879, this unfair and dangerous practice will be stopped. Specifically, the bill does two things to end this practice. One, it adds the word defend to the definition of indemnity agreement, and two, it deletes the ambiguous words project-specific insurance, including without limitation. First, by adding defend to the definition of indemnity agreement, you tie fault and legal costs back together. The party that is responsible for the damage would also be responsible for their own legal fees. Again, this ties back to the prior change in the law in 2013. If this bill is passed, a general contractor could still require a subcontractor to pay for and insure the general contractor for any costs related to the subcontractor's fault or negligence. That's right in the bill. It's also part of the vicarious liability exception that this amendment does not touch. That's already in current law. Second, by deleting the words or project-specific insurance, including without limitation, you will close a loophole that some general contractors are using to pass all costs and legal fees and actual damages caused by the general onto subcontractors, even when the general is solely negligent. This is just about basic fairness. Subcontractors are not trying to get out of being responsible for their own actions or their own legal fees. They just don't want to pay the general's legal fees when the general is negligent.
Thank you. Are there any other testifiers that wish to speak for or against the bill? Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Coney. I'm Deputy Chief Counsel at MnDOT.
MnDOT is concerned about unintended consequences of this bill, which I will share with you briefly. We believe that there will be more rather than less construction-related litigation, and at the same time there's more litigation, there will be less incentive to settle cases. Parties will need to litigate cases to their completion in order to allocate fault and then determine defense costs. We believe that owners, including public owners, will be forced to defend suits that arise from a contractor's conduct in which the contractor should really be in the position of defending, and which, in fact, they probably have insurance that covers their defense of that lawsuit as well. And last but not least, this bill alters, for just one particular context, construction. This bill alters a long-established legal principle that the duty to defend is different from and broader than the duty to indemnify. And those are MnDOT's concerns about the unintended consequences of this bill. Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Are there any other testifiers to the bill? Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Mark Belinsky. I'm with Cross Anderson Construction Company. I'm also here, however, on behalf of the Associate General Contractors of Minnesota, which is a nonprofit professional trade association devoted to construction and building and highway construction contractors. So, thanks for the time to give you a few points of some of the concerns regarding the HF 879. You know, constituents and stakeholders are encouraged by the legislature to work collaboratively and negotiate resolutions and develop consensus on bills brought to the legislature to avoid unintended consequences. And that's precisely what occurred back in 2013 during the when the statute 337 was amended, as referenced by the other testifiers. At that time, then Senator Jensen and Representative Atkins worked with the various stakeholders, including the AGC and the proponents of the bill at that time, which was related to alleviating broad form indemnification agreements in Minnesota construction contracts. I was part of that discussion and negotiation, and that compromise was in fact reached with Senator Jensen and Representative Atkins on May 10th, 2013. And the proponents to that bill at that time ratified that amendment to Chapter 337, and that went into law effective August 1st of 2013. Those discussions, and I can speak from firsthand knowledge, those discussions specifically included a reference to the duty to defend continuing to be part of indemnification law. And the reason for that is that the amendments to the statute took place in Section 337.05, which is agreements to insure. And part of any insurance obligation in and of itself is the duty to defend, as the other testifier noted, which is broader than the duty to indemnify. So for example, if you own a home and somebody is walking on your sidewalk and they slip on the ice and they then sue you for that injury, your homeowner's insurance, liability insurance, is going to defend you against that lawsuit whether or not you are ultimately found liable for damage to that person. That's the difference between defense and indemnity. Indemnity would be if that person actually was injured and you were responsible, you would have to indemnify for the damages that were caused. So that is why there is this distinction, and that is why the amendment in 2013 specifically contemplated it. One thing to keep in mind is that there was discussion about basic fairness and that subcontractors or lower tier subcontractors or primes only want to be responsible for what they do or cause. And the problem is that in Minnesota, you have to keep in mind that general contractors or upstream prime contractors have a common law and contractual duty for vicarious responsibility for those that are contracting below them. So imagine a scenario where you rent out your house to a tenant and you still own the house, your tenant lives in the house, and your tenant does something to injure somebody and you get sued as the owner of the home. You may have responsibility because you had a tenant living in your home, but I don't think anybody in this room would want to be defending that lawsuit and the costs that are incurred to defend that lawsuit if you weren't ultimately responsible, but you may be responsible by operation of law. And so you would have an agreement, a lease, that would require your tenant to defend and potentially indemnify you from the lawsuit that was brought against you. That is exactly what we're talking about here in the construction industry. When we talk about the duty to defend, it is insurable, it is reasonable, and it is not something that a general contractor can use under the current law to require a subcontractor to defend the general contractor from its sole negligence. It is not allowed. The law specifically prohibits it. It has to be related to the subcontractor's work before the defense obligation ever kicks in. So there has to be a nexus to it. And so the comments, many of which we heard back in 2013, are the same, but the issue was resolved, it was agreed upon, and it's surprising that, you know, we're here again. We have been since 2014 fighting the same battle. One other thing to keep in mind as you consider this bill, in 2014, which is the year after the amendment was passed, a bill carried by Speaker Hortman and Senator Latz related to indemnity that was that's required from construction design professionals was passed into law after those authors and various groups undertook collaborative process to reach agreement and consensus on that bill. That bill was codified in 604.21 of Minnesota statutes, and that was done in 2014. And that addressed a discrete issue with design professionals who in some instances cannot get insurance to cover their indemnity obligations. However, that bill, and that law that is in law now, 604.21, specifically allows defense and indemnity in those instances, and I'm quoting from the bill, where insurance is available to cover those obligations. It specifically allows for defense in those cases. And this is the same principle that was agreed to in 2013 as part of the amendment to 337. And importantly, if this bill is passed, it will be in direct conflict with Section 604.21 of Minnesota statutes. So you will have uncertainty in the construction industry. In one case, you may have design professionals that can provide a defense in a construction contract, but in other cases, contractors and subcontractors cannot. And that, again, will lead to increased litigation, not decreased litigation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. One more time, is there any other testifiers that wish to speak to this bill? Thank you, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Remy Stone. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota, primarily residential construction contractors and our subcontractors. I'm not going to get into all the legal weediness of all of this because it's not where I spend my time, but I do want to share with you that we do have a concern, a reservation about the legislation that unlike commercial construction, home builders are licensed in this state. Unlike subcontractors in residential construction, residential contractors are licensed in this state. And as a condition of maintaining our license, we need to maintain general liability insurance. And we're finding more and more often that our general liability insurance are requiring us to maintain indemnification clauses that include a duty to defend in our contracts in order to maintain our insurance, to maintain our licenses. So I just wanted to put that out there and put it on the record that we do have that concern with this legislation. If it passes, we may be seeing an unintended consequence that will impact our ability to maintain licensure.
Thank you very much. Seeing no other testifiers, are there any questions from committee members? Seeing none, Representative Sundin, any further comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple quick comments here. I noticed that MnDOT jumped in with the general contractors on this, and there's been several references to upstream contractors and downstream contractors. I've worked for several, multiple downstream contractors. I've seen them suffer the heavy hand of general contractors from time to time, including on holding money back and the liability issues as well. So in the handout that I received from the AGC, they referenced the upstream, downstream effects here, and I highlighted one passage. Even though the upstream contractors has little control over how the subcontractor performs its work, actual work performance is one thing, but the selection of subcontractors is solely on in the hands of the general contractor or MnDOT as well. There's bidding parameters that must be followed, and they do have discretion on how they can select contractors or refuse for good cause. So I see the downstream contractors suffering from the pollution from up above. So those are my comments for today. Thank you.
All right. Representative Sundin will renew his motion that House File 879 be re-referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. Next on the agenda is Representative Hansen with House File 1860. And I will move House File 1860 be re-referred to Ways and Means. We have the bill before us. We also have an A2 amendment. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And House File 1860 is following up on the Office of Legislative Auditor's evaluation from January of 2015, and I have with me the audit program manager who did the audit. I would note the amendment is not mine, but I would accept it if that would move things along.
Representative Vogel, I understand the amendment is comes from your turf.
It does. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a clarification, because I'm not opposed to the bill itself necessarily, but I just thought from the employer standpoint it would be important to just define a little more what's expected there, so that there's no there's no misunderstanding going forward on how to determine what kind of language that the notice would have to be given. So just a simple clarification, basically.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the A2 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor adopting the A2 say aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, proceed, please.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. So this legislation arises from the Packing House Workers Bill of Rights, which was originally passed in 2007, that had a program evaluation audit in 2015 to see how it was working, and I have with me Mr. Kirchner to talk about the audit. There were recommendations from the legislative auditor, and that's what the bill is, and now with the clarifying amendment from Representative Vogel. So,
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name, for the record, is David Kirchner. I'm an evaluator with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I was the project manager for our evaluation of state protections for meatpacking workers in 2015. And the bill that Representative Hansen has brought forward does reflect our recommendations that the original language, both of the Packing House Workers Bill of Rights and another law on the books related to meatpacking plants, needed a little bit clearer, a little bit more clarification. To begin with, the law did not have a particularly good or any really definition of what meatpacking includes. Does it include all meat processing? Does it include poultry processing? Does it include rendering plants? Does it include pet food? Does it include the companies that sanitize, that come in and clean and sanitize those meat processing facilities? So this bill does put into place a more clear definition. Another thing that we pointed out is that in a different law, it requires that employers provide information to their employees in both English and Spanish. And while that made sense perhaps in 1995 when the law was originally written, we found that in 2015 when we were looking at meatpacking plants, there were a large number of immigrants from Africa and from Southeast Asia that are working in these plants, and offering them either English or Spanish was not a particularly useful way of providing them information. Another thing that we observed in our visits to meatpacking plants is that the administrators in those plants told us that they often were really working hard to provide training to employees in ways other than in writing. They were providing trainees using videos and using one-to-one conversations, and in part that was because they were finding that some of their employees did not read well in any language. And so the bill that Representative Hansen is bringing forth emphasizes the importance not just of written communication, but also other forms of communication as well, so that employees that have difficulty reading can get that information. I think that covers most of the things that were in our recommendations that are in this bill.
Thank you. Representative Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. And so that, again, this is pretty simple. This is the recommendations from the legislative auditor. I do have with me Bernie Hess to give a perspective from labor.
Mr. Hess.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. My name is Bernie Hess. I'm with the Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 1189. We represent workers in retail, healthcare, and food processing, along with meatpacking. We want to thank Representative Hansen for bringing this forth. House File 1860 is a good bill. We feel this will really help not only with workers, but also with companies. The thing that's changed the most in processing since the late 70s and 80s for us that were around is technology. There's also been tons of automation, line speeds, and then compression in the industry also. There used to be like 16 major packers. Now we're down to about six dominant packers in the U.S. So there's been a lot of change in the industry. Also, the reintroduction of the immigrant workforce has kept a number of plants open in Minnesota, I would argue. They need the bodies. We need the newly arrived to be able to work in a place where they understand, you know, anything basic safety procedures, how they get paid, their rights, and it brings back with folks working in these plants throughout Minnesota, I think it's brought back a lot of vitality to Main Street and outstate Minnesota. So let's advance this. Let's equip the workers with knowledge about their rights and obligations also. And this will help retain workers in these communities and keep these plants running. Please support this bill. We want to thank Representative Hansen for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to weigh in on the issue, on the bill? Okay, seeing none, any further questions for the author? Representative Hansen, any final? Oh, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just curious, you said we're down to six packers. I'm wondering where they're located and what are they packing?
To the Chair, Representative Fabian, when I say six, I'm talking about six national packers. Okay. In the state, we've got about 30 large operations that are continuing. You know, you've got swine, you've got poultry and beef slaughter, harvesting and fabrication now, so yeah.
Thank you, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've toured the Northern Pride Turkey Processing Plant in Thief River Falls. And just for the record, when you mentioned the late 70s and changes have been made, on the mid-70s, I worked at the Flavorland Meatpacking Plant in West Fargo, North Dakota. And when they say all beef wieners, yes, they're all beef. But I'll leave it at that.
Representative Fabian, how many fingers do you have? Okay, good. That's good. It's good to see.
I was a lugger.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. Final word on the bill, Chair Hansen.
I'd appreciate your support. You know, this has been it's a long time since Mr. Kirchner had to dust off the audit from 2015, and would like to move forward. And even since 2015, there's been a lot of change with those Packers. There's been changes in ownership. You know, that since 2015, one of the largest was in my district, was a South St. Paul packing house. And so there's changes that continue in the industry, changing workforce, and I think House File 1860 would help, and represent Claflin's district, I should say, both of our districts. Things keep changing, and I think this would be a good help.
We've got another 40 minutes of committee time if you want to continue. Okay. At this time, I'm going to renew my motion. House File 1860 be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion passes. Any other comments for the committee? Our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 13th in this room. Committee's adjourned. Thank you.